From Arizona to Ohio, Massachusetts to Michigan, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, to be elected president, a candidate needs 270 electoral votes. Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies is here to look at how each party can get to that number. Forget about legislating. The 2020 political season has already hit high gear in the nation's capital. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. Are conservatives growing more nationalist and moving away from libertarianism? Eric Boehm and Stephanie Slade of Reason Magazine explore. And 50 years ago, Neil Armstrong made history by becoming the first man to set foot on the moon. Colin Hanna remembers how the nation came together to accomplish that task on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It takes 270 electoral votes to become president, and the road to that victory differs from winning a majority of popular votes cast. Here to look at the roadmap to 270 for both President Trump and the eventual Democrat Party nominee is Keith Naughton. Keith is principal of Silent Majority Strategies. Keith, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Keith, before we talk about President Trump's pathway to another Electoral College victory and also taking a look at what the Democrats will have to do to win in the Electoral College, tell us a bit about it. What is the Electoral College and how does it work?
The Electoral College is how we decide who the president is. The winning candidate has to get a majority of the Electoral College votes, which means getting the highest number of votes in states representing a majority in the Electoral College. And that majority is 270 votes. We have 538 votes total. That represents all of the elected members of the House of Representatives, all the senators, plus three votes for the District of Columbia.
And as we look at the Electoral College, then, Keith, does this not protect the rights of smaller states so that they, in fact, have some say in this election of the president?
Well, that was the original, one of the original intents, at least, of the founders, is to ensure that a few large states don't dominate the entire process. It's a sort of affirmative action for smaller states, if you will.
President Trump, of course, prevailed in the Electoral College in the 2016 election, did not win the popular vote. So that, of course, has been a rallying point for the left. But we still have the Electoral College. We're likely to still have it going forward. So let's talk for a couple minutes about President Trump, Keith, and the fact that he put together a majority of the electoral votes in order to win in 2016. That pathway, though, depended on slim victories in several states. Do you want to review that? And what is his pathway to winning in 2020?
Well, in 2016, he won with 306, or he won states representing 306 electoral votes versus Clinton winning states representing 232 electoral votes. So his path to winning is to simply defend. So he has a certain advantage. He doesn't have to pick anything up. In fact, he can still lose a couple of the larger states. He could still lose Pennsylvania and Michigan, which he won very narrowly, and still have the 270 needed to win. The problem with that is that the next state down the line, Wisconsin, was very narrow as well. He won Michigan by less than a quarter of 1%. He won Pennsylvania by less than 0.75%, and he won Wisconsin by 0.77%. So those are very short margins, and that's the real challenge for him. If he holds any one of those three states, he can be a winner. What he really, where his strategy is really pivoting on is Wisconsin, which of the three states he won by the largest margin, if just slightly. So he's got to have a contingency that replaces Wisconsin and its 10 electoral votes. So he's going to need to win Nevada plus either New Hampshire or New Mexico or Colorado in order to replace those 10 votes from Wisconsin. He lost New Hampshire very narrowly by less than one half of 1%. He lost Nevada by 2.5 percentage points, Colorado by a little under 5, and New Mexico by a little over 8. Obviously, New Mexico is a much more challenging state. So this is really where the pivot is. He's pivoting around Wisconsin. If he he can win it, good. If he can't, he's got to pick up those 10 votes. And that's driving his entire electoral strategy.
That is the president's pathway to victory. Now, let's talk about the Democrats. As you pointed out, Hillary Clinton fell short by three states, by three big states. What do Democrats have to do? Where do they have to go to win in order to get up to that 270 vote threshold?
Well, the Democrats could pursue either what I call a northern strategy or a southern strategy. If they pick up those three states they lost by less than 1%, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, then the candidate wins. And of course, you have to defend all the states that they won the last time. Alternately, they could pick up Florida and either Arizona or North Carolina and win. Florida's got 29 electoral votes. That's obviously a big prize. Donald Trump won that by 1.2%, so very close. And he won Arizona and North Carolina by a little over 3.5%. However, those two states are trending more Democratic over time, even though the Democrats haven't won Arizona since 1948. They've won North Carolina a couple of times in the interim in the last few cycles. So they're a little bit hopeful on those states. So either of those paths work. Alternately, if they win Florida, all they have to do is pick up one of these northern or Midwestern states and still win. So that's the strategy I think they're going to be pursuing going forward.
So it looks like we are headed for another closely contested race here. All, of course, depends on who becomes the Democratic nominee and what economic circumstances are as we head into next October, November, a long way away, of course. One state you haven't mentioned, Keith, is Virginia. And the Old Dominion had been somewhat reliably Republican. It has lately trended Democrat. Do you see that as a possible battleground state also?
Possible. I'm not really thinking that states where the margin was 5% or higher either way are probably not in play. The Democrats, Clinton won Virginia by about 5.3%. I think when you get into those states, if you're competitive or if you lose those states, where the Democrats to lose Virginia, they're probably losing a lot of other states. It's the same thing on the Republican side. If Donald Trump was to lose Georgia, which he won by just a little over 5%, he's probably lost more states, and we're probably looking at a landslide. So when we're parsing these pathways, they're contingent on it being a close election. And it's possible that it won't be a close election. If the economy takes a turn for the worse, there's no indication that's going to happen right now, but it's always possible. That would be fatal to the president's campaign. If, on the other hand, the Democrats nominate a candidate who proposes a series of proposals way outside the mainstream, or people feel that it's threatening the economy or it's just too extreme, then the president could win in a strong landslide.
We will continue to check in with Keith Naughton, who is president of Silent Majority Strategies, as we go through the election, and we will keep an eye on these various bellwether electoral college vote states. Keith, if we have folks who would like to contact you, how can they do that?
Well, I'm on Twitter at knaughton711, so you can follow me there and all the articles I write. I'm a contributor also to The Hill, and you can read some of my analysis in that periodical.
Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies. Keith, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. It has been, shall we say, a wild and woolly week in Washington. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, and I think wild is one way to categorize it.
Well, it certainly is almost unprecedented, at least in modern times, what's been going on. And Scott, just to sort of set the stage here, as we look at what's happening, particularly in the United States House of Representatives, are we really into 2020 campaign mode and the whole idea of actually legislating or doing the business of government is out the window?
I think that's right, except for the must-pass pieces of legislation, those items that have any sort of a timeline where there would be a lapse in government operations if the timeline isn't met. The federal spending will still get done at some point, but the big legislative priorities of the Democrat House majority, those are all political messaging that they're doing with the Green New Deal And certainly with their posturing with contempt and impeachment resolutions against the Trump administration. So I think it's fair to say at this point in July of 2019, it is 100% about the 2020 campaign.
In terms of that impeachment resolution that came up this past week and, of course, failed, is this just Democrat, the ultra-left-wing Democrat faction in the House playing to their base? Is it really going beyond that?
I think it is mostly playing to the progressive base. It's certainly playing to identity politics. This week, what we saw with the impeachment resolution that was offered by Congressman Al Green, that was a posturing move, in my view. They knew it was never going to pass, and they did that because they want to charge President Trump with being a racist. You may recall just a few days prior to the Trump tweet, Trump was actually defending Nancy Pelosi against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, saying that Pelosi was not a racist herself. And then all of a sudden, 3 days later, it's all about how racist Trump is. So that's how the political winds shift here in Washington. And so with those impeachment resolutions, they're privileged resolutions, meaning anybody in the House of Representatives at any time can move to impeach the president or another impeachable official in our government. So you're talking about judges, you're talking about other members of the administration. You could certainly impeach a Supreme Court justice. There's many instances within our nation's history of actual successful impeachment vote, but once the House impeaches, then the Senate goes ahead and considers whether to convict. But nonetheless, the impeachment resolution this week failed. There were only 95 House Democrats that voted against tabling the motion. That means that they wanted to consider the full debate. And the majority, 137 Democrats and all 194 voting House Republicans. There were a couple of Republicans that missed the vote, but those that did vote all voted to table the resolution. That resolution was tabled, and then we also had another resolution against Secretary Wilbur Ross and the Attorney General William Barr. And what happened here was the House Democrats are mostly fed up with the Trump administration's view that they shouldn't have to turn over documents related to this question of the United States Census and whether there should be a citizenship question. So the Commerce Department and the Justice Department have been considering how to handle the U.S. Census for 2020 for many, many months. And with the House Democratic majority, they have certainly sought to extract any documents that they think they could use as a political weapon to, again, charge President Trump and those in his administration with trying to fix elections for Republicans and whites in particular.
Setting aside all the impeachment theatrics and all the name-calling that occurred, President Trump, in calling out these four freshman Democratic congresswomen who have, in fact, proposed some ultra left-wing socialist policies, has he now, as a result of that, Scott, successfully framed the entire Democrat Party as being in that out of the mainstream left wing?
I think that to frame them as the leaders of the left, that is certainly fair. They are driving the political debate here in Washington. They're the ones that are really dictating the messaging that's coming out of the House Democratic Conference. And they call themselves the squad. They're the four brand new members to Washington. And they're not playing by the old establishment rules that have for so long dominated the way that Washington works. So to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's credit, she's not willing to stand in line. She took on the vice chair of the Democratic Conference with Joe Crowley, beating him in a primary last summer. And the voters that sent her to Washington sent her here on a mandate to totally mix up the progressive left, and she's done that to her credit. Now, when we compare them between House Republican vision of economic opportunity and prosperity and all Americans having the ability to be self-sufficient, or the Democrat left Green New Deal, we want everybody dependent on government, we're going to give everybody free stuff, we're going to confiscate wealth, I think that that's a pretty big difference in terms of the vision. So President Trump has done a good job at bringing to attention through his tweets and through his other messaging in the bully pulpit, a sort of a focus on these four members. And Pelosi's sort of scrambling. This week when they did that impeachment resolution, Nancy Pelosi broke the House rules, and for the first time since 1984, a House Speaker's words were taken down from the official record. I would say, in the end, I want to go back to that big vote. There was 332 to only 95 voting for the impeachment resolution and against tabling it. So overwhelmingly, this is a issue that it's not put to bed. They can move to impeachment at any time, but for now, Trump lives another day against the House Democrat majority.
And once again, no focus on actually dealing with the problems facing the country. It's all politics all the time. And of course, we will continue to keep an eye on that as we move forward. Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is an organization based out of our nation's capital. We have over 250,000 members of the Club for Growth. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out, they can look us up on our website, www.clubforgrowth.org, and they can follow us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll talk with you next week.
Thanks.
Nationalists, conservatives, and libertarians all occupy the right side of the political spectrum. But there are growing differences, as we learn from Eric Boehm and Stephanie Slade of Reason Magazine.
You're probably old enough to remember a time when all conservatives really, or at least most of them, would have agreed that it's not the federal government's job to solve most problems. But that is today a premise that is increasingly coming under attack, even from within the conservative movement. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Stephanie Slade. She's the managing editor of Reason Magazine, and she was an attendee this past week at the National Conservatism Conference in Washington, D.C., where this new, more muscular strain of center-right politics was on full display. You can call it nationalism, you can call it what you want. It's clear that there's definitely something going on, a clear break between the more sort of libertarian, free market minded conservatism of the past and what some on the right are now advocating for. Stephanie, we appreciate you taking some time to be here and tell us about it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
As I said, you were in attendance this week. You were there listening and taking it all in at the National Conservatism Conference. Before we get into some of the specifics, I guess I'm just curious for your thoughts in general of this new strain of conservatism that's appeared on the right. What do you make of it?
I think what we're seeing happen right now on the American right, you know, right of center politics, is a crumbling of the traditional sort of three-legged stool of the American right. For many, many years, you had libertarian economics as one component, sort of free market economics, the support for free trade, as one component of what it meant to be a conservative in America. And I think that's increasingly no longer the case. And this conference represented almost a precise inversion of that vision for what a conservative economics ought to look like. A nationalist economics, even a conservative nationalist economics, is ultimately a big government, interventionist, anti-trade, protectionist sort of program. And so that's what we're now seeing among some pretty influential people on the American right.
Yeah, you mentioned prominent voices on the right, a number of them on display this week at the conference. And Stephanie, your piece that's up at Reason.com right now takes a look at some of that, including something that J.D. Vance said. Of course, Vance is the author of Hillbilly Elegy. It's a book that's gotten quite a bit of attention here in the last few years as Trump has become president and as this sort of more nationalistic strain on the right has emerged. Vance talking this week about how the sort of collapse of jobs in some parts of the country, about the opioid crisis, about some of these big problems. And he seems to give voice to this idea that some of the crises that America seems to be facing at the moment can't be solved by individual action or by community groups of voluntary association. And that was always sort of what conservatives looked to instead of government to solve social problems. But now there's a sense, I guess, that it's just not possible for us to fix some of or to order society the way it should be ordered unless, I guess, the government is doing it for us?
I think the most sort of charitable description of what's happening or explanation for where they're coming from is that this group of conservatives is looking at parts of the country far away from the coast that are where there's a lot of struggling. There's people are struggling. The manufacturing sector of this country has changed and in some cases gone away. And that does, definitely does have an impact on real people. And so the opioid crisis is real. There's a real phenomenon happening there. And they look at that and they say, well, we tried libertarian economics and we got this. And so we're going to try the opposite now. I don't think that's the right solution for a variety of reasons. I think many of the worst problems that are sort of plaguing these parts of the country are actually, they're caused or exacerbated by too much government intervention, not letting the markets work. But that's, I think that's at least where this sort of cohort is coming from.
We are talking with Stephanie Slade. She's the managing editor of Reason Magazine, and she was an attendee this past week at the National Conservatism Conference in Washington, D.C., where this new sort of nationalist strain of conservatism was definitely on full display. Stephanie, before I let you go, I do want to just sort of push back on this. I mean, you and I are both self-described libertarians. We work for a libertarian publication, even though we came to libertarianism through conservatism. And I think you and I don't want to speak for you, but I think we both have an appreciation for the fusionism that's been on display between conservatives and libertarians really for decades now, going back even before the Reagan years. But I imagine there's a lot of people probably listening to this conversation that think we're part of the problem, that think libertarians are to blame for some of these problems that have sort of moved conservatism in a different direction in recent years. Is there still common cause between libertarians and conservatives, or is this schism going to only grow as we go forward here?
It does seem like that alliance is fraying, the sort of fusionist alliance has frayed. I don't think it's necessary that it has to. And I've made the case that I really do believe, so fusionism was this idea that you can have sort of traditional virtue and liberty coexisting and that they actually are important to bring those together. And this is like a driving, that synthesis is like a driving force behind the Reagan Revolution, for example. Virtue and morality and deep commitment to individual liberty. I think that's totally sustainable if there is a political will for it. But that is, it's certainly possible and intellectually coherent to say that the government should focus on protecting our rights and our liberties, and that we in the civil society, in the private sphere, in our interactions with each other, through all the many, many intermediary institutions that are out there, churches and neighborhood groups and all of that stuff, can focus on the cultivating virtue and lifting us each other, ourselves and each other, up towards the highest good. We don't have to throw away the highest good or the idea of a common good. We just have to say that that's not the job of government to tell us what it is and to get us there. It's our, we have that responsibility ourselves.
So certainly this is a big topic, a big conversation in center-right politics, and one that will continue long after we are done here. We are unfortunately out of time for today. Stephanie Slade, managing editor of Reason Magazine, thanks for taking some time and being here.
Thank you.
And again, you can check out Slade's latest piece, her reporting from the National Conservatism Conference, that is up right now at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
It was one small step for a man, but a national effort that allowed Neil Armstrong to make that giant leap for mankind. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
A very interesting book was published a dozen or so years ago titled Where Were You When? The cover has photos of President and Mrs. Kennedy, the Beatles arriving in the U.S. for the first time, Princess Diana, and the burning World Trade Center after it was attacked on September 11 as the first tower was falling. But the largest photo on the cover is of Neil Armstrong walking on the moon. That momentous event occurred exactly 50 years ago. Where were you on that day? Many of our listeners were not even born, and many were too young to watch it or remember watching it. But for those of us who were glued to a TV set somewhere, watching something that was literally out of this world, we will never forget it, and we will never forget where we were when we saw it. I was a young Navy ensign serving in the Pentagon. My wife and I owned the smallest and cheapest color TV we could find at Sears, so we accepted an invitation to see it on a friend's large screen color TV. The largest screen available at that time was 23 inches, but that seemed immense compared to the 17-inch screen we had. I brought my 35mm camera and a tripod so that I could take photos of the TV showing that historic moment. I had studied what the shutter speed and f-stop should be to get a good picture. I knew we'd be observing history, and I wanted to be sure to record it. 50 years later, we still recognize that achievement as one of the greatest triumphs of American technology. But it seems to me that even more important than the technology involved were the vision and national commitment involved. Listen to some of what President Kennedy said in his famous moon speech at Rice University barely 8 years earlier on May 25, 1961. I believe we possess all the resources and talents necessary, but the facts of the matter are that we have never made the national decisions or marshaled the national resources required for such leadership. We have never specified long-range goals on an urgent time schedule or managed our resources and our time so as to ensure their fulfillment. I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. We propose to accelerate the development of the appropriate lunar spacecraft. We propose to develop alternate liquid and solid fuel boosters, much larger than any now being developed, until we're certain which is superior. We propose additional funds for other engine development and for unmanned explorations, explorations which are particularly important for one purpose which this nation will never overlook, the survival of the man who first makes this daring flight. But in a very real sense, it will not be one man going to the moon. If we make this judgment affirmatively, it will be an entire nation. For all of us must work to put him there. I think every citizen of this country, as well as the members of the Congress, should consider the matter carefully in making their judgment, because it is a heavy burden, and there is no sense in agreeing or desiring that the United States take an affirmative position in outer space unless we are prepared to do the work and bear the burdens to make it successful. This decision demands a major national commitment of scientific and technical manpower, materiel, and facilities. End of quote from President Kennedy. There may have been some, maybe even many, who thought that the entire moon project was a harebrained scheme and a terrible waste of money, but they were soon swept away by the irresistible optimism of Kennedy's call to a grand national goal. We didn't know how to build a large enough rocket or even to design a spacesuit to keep a man alive on the surface of the moon, but the entire nation was soon caught up in the commitment to this ambitious plan whose failure was unacceptable and thus unthinkable. That is leadership at its best. So, as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Neil Armstrong's walk on the moon, let's also celebrate the 58th anniversary of visionary, inspiring, and unifying leadership. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WFAM-AM in Augusta, Georgia, WBXR-AM in Huntsville, Alabama, along with WELP-AM in Greenville, South Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.